Jill Friesen from the University of Oxford. I'm part of the Learning Technologies Group. I must admit that my area of expertise is not learning design, and I don't use LAMS. So you might wonder what I'm doing here. My background is as an instructional designer, and I'm addressing the conference themes of sharing ideas and perhaps building learning communities, because my primary role is to support academics in thinking about how they might use technology. You're here at Oxford in lovely summer weather that we're having, but this was just to remind you about the snow that we had in January, which was quite unseasonal, but of course it did make Oxford look more beautiful. Our offices, the group that I belong to is part of Oxford University Computing Services. We have offices in a suite of 5 Victorian houses. And this is where we'll be going tomorrow for the Design Bash, OUCS. So that was me outside our offices in January, but we do get some sunshine and summer weather as well. So that's the building that we'll be going to tomorrow for the Design Bash. Just to put it in context as to how we fit into Oxford University Computing Services, the Central Computing Services consists of various teams and various groups, about 130 people altogether. Within that, I'm in the Learning Technologies Group. Melissa Highton, who opened the conference today, is the head of the LTG. We do have an initiative and a project for looking at mobile Oxford. So that's the one out there on the right-hand side. It's not part of the Learning Technologies Group, strangely enough. But within the LTG, we have various different groups and teams. Podcasting, we have a team looking at computer modelling. We have a training program which offers formal courses in IT literacy training. And I teach on that to do with the use of our VLE, our virtual learning environment. And I'm in the WebLearn team. WebLearn is the name of our VLE. Perhaps it's better if I don't stand quite so close to the microphone. So WebLearn is the name of the VLE that we use. It's an open source VLE. It's Sakai, for those of you who know of and have used Sakai or Moodle or perhaps other VLEs. So WebLearn is the name that we have given to our VLE, and we have a team of 3.5 people. In other words, 3 full-time people and 1 person who shares his time between the VLE team and the podcasting team. So it's a very small team, as you can see. Now, this morning, Melissa mentioned a few facts and figures, so I won't go into that in detail, but you can see there's quite a large number of students, 20,000, 4 divisions. In other countries, they would be called faculties. 38 colleges and 6 private halls, and what makes it complicated and complex is that they are all independent and self-governing. So you have the centralized university, the body that confers the degrees, and you have the colleges and departments who are responsible for the teaching and learning, and research, of course, as well as other things. The oldest colleges were established by the 13th century, so we are dealing with a lot of tradition. And as Melissa mentioned this morning, we have to be rather subtle in how we approach this idea of technology-enhanced learning. Lots of buildings spread around throughout the city, lots of libraries spread throughout the city. So it's not one campus with one gateway and one administration and one reception. It really is a university city, as you would know. I thought it was important to clarify some different terms and terminology that are used. I've seen we have an international audience here. I come from South Africa, so on the right-hand side, those are the terms that I was used to using, a learning management system, whereas in the UK we talk about a virtual learning environment. I'm trained as an instructional designer. Here I'm called a learning technologist. And I think the biggest difference is the third row there, that in my previous experience, a tutor was a teaching assistant or a graduate student who would perhaps guide and help students and answer questions. Whereas with the Oxford model, a tutor is far more than that. A tutor is a very well-respected, established scholar, a leading expert in the field. So I'm going to be using the UK terminology in the rest of this presentation. So do understand what I mean when I talk about a tutor. Linking up with this idea of tutors in their formal and original sense. Of course, if we think back to the Socratic method in ancient times, that was the main form of inquiry and debate, how people learned. They learned from the experts, the people who would gather together in the forum, the physical Greek and Roman forum, where they would have discussions and share ideas, stimulate critical thinking and to illuminate ideas. So I think that's quite nice to keep that ancient idea in mind as to what is a tutor and what is a forum and what is deep learning and meaningful learning. Of course, we can't continue that in modern times necessarily, in large modern universities with large numbers of students. But that diagram there shows a single conversation across the table with a wise man is better than 10 years mere study of books. So even books are a threat to this Socratic ideal. And it just highlights our dilemma in trying to look at how technology can support pedagogy. Change, of course, is a problem. Resistance to change, particularly in traditional universities, where things have been done the same way for hundreds of years. And I think it helps to remember that change actually is a certainty. We can be certain that change is here to stay. It's also ironic that nowhere is faculty resistance to change so pronounced as it is in the activity of teaching. So it's quite a dilemma. Why do we find this barrier to new ideas and to adoption of technology? Technology-enhanced practice. I've always believed, as the previous speaker said, that it's the pedagogy, of course, that's important, and we're all focusing on design here, so I'm sure I'm speaking to the converted. But we have to, again, look at our continuum, what is blended learning, blending together what happens in the classroom, in the traditional face-to-face environment, and using the online or the technology-enhanced environment to support what we do, coming up with blended practice. I like the JISC definition of blended learning, which is the skillful combination of online resources and face-to-face activities to promote independent, self-directed learning. So I think that's coming back again to this Socratic idea of a learner who takes responsibility for their learning and makes best use of all the resources available to them. Now, in my previous experience, we worked on the ideas used by Curtis Bonk from the University of Indiana. And earlier, James mentioned about the Moodle expert who was talking about different levels of engagement and application of technology. So possibly one would start off at this first level. Bonk has 10 levels. We've synthesized this down to 3 levels. So I like to think of the first level as web-supported. In other words, you're primarily in a face-to-face environment and you're using the web as a supportive medium. You might put learning resources there, make them available to the learners 24/7. You might use tools like calendars, announcements, and other resources. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. That graphic shows a postbox. So yes, it is a repository of resources, but perhaps that's the first place to start. And if that is going to help the teachers and meet the needs of the learners, I think that's a good place to start. As you move up this continuum, the next stage would be web-enhanced, where you're moving more into the blended environment, you're using more and more tools, and of course the bulleted points that you put there, you would adapt to your own institution. This is where you would be using the learning management system in more depth, using some more of its more sophisticated tools, bringing in the idea of discussions, interaction with peers, collaborative learning, etc., perhaps using it for assessment activities. Until you get to the third level, web-dependent. So those terms, web-supported, web-enhanced, and web-dependent, is my own synthesis from the literature, but that's what's worked for me in the past in talking to academics as to where they might like to imagine themselves on this continuum, and whether they're happy to stay where they are or if they'd like to stretch themselves a bit further. I'm sure you also all know about Moore's adoption curve. Do you? Is everyone, could you have a show of hands to see who is familiar with Moore's adoption curve? It's well known.
It's not Edward Rogers.
Well, I'm referring to the book Crossing the Chasm by Moore in 1999. This diagram doesn't actually show the chasms, but there are one or more chasms in this curve, which make it difficult for adopters of technology to cross from one zone into the other. So you start off with innovators, people who are ahead of the crowd, who are trying things out just because they want to see how they work. They have ideas that they'd like to try out. Then you have the early adopters, the people who are inspired by these ideas, they'd like to join the group and try some of the things themselves. I think that's where you get the chasm, from the early adopters to the early majority. It's difficult to then get the majority of users on board with whatever particular technology it is that you're looking at. And hopefully you will eventually get the late majority on board. By that stage you're talking about the majority of people. But you will always have the laggards, the people who are slow to adopt technology and perhaps never will. And perhaps you don't even want to try and get them on board. So as learning technologists, this is a challenge for us to look at our users, to look at the academics, to look at the teachers, and to see where they might be on this curve, what is comfortable for them in terms of adopting technology and what is not comfortable. We decided to actually ask some of our academics as to where they thought they were on this curve. We have a user group called the WebLearn User Group. I'll tell you more about that in a while. And at one of our meetings, I think it was November last year, we decided to present this idea of this adoption curve to our users. We had about 30 people in the room. So we had a handout which explained to them the concepts here. And then we drew a curve and we asked them to plot where they imagined themselves to be on the curve. Because without doing a full-scale research project, it's actually difficult to get an idea of where your users are. So we did that, and that's a photograph of where they plotted themselves on the curve. Now, it very soon materialized that we needed two colors of dots, because we had the enthusiasts actually in the room with us. They were our WebLearn users. Some of them were the IT support people and not necessarily the end user academics. So they very soon said, well, can we have two dots of different colors, because I want to put myself in one place, but the academics that I work with are not necessarily in the same place as me. So that's what we did. The blue dots are where they placed themselves, the people that were present at our user group meeting, and the orange dots are where they placed their colleagues. So you can see that the blue dots are congregated around the early adopters. As I say, those were the people that were using WebLearn and supporting others to do so. But that across the this is not across the institution, but from this sample, you can see that there's quite a wide spread of other people further down the curve. And the challenge is to try to reach those people. So that was an interesting exercise for both ourselves and for the users to see where they sit. What are some of the barriers to moving along that curve and adopting technology? A lack of conviction about the benefits, what's in it for me and what's in it for my students. I think those are really the two most important things from the point of view of an academic. What's in it for me? How is it going to help me? Is it going to save time? How much of my time is it going to take to build a virtual learning classroom? And of course, how will it enhance my students' learning and help them to achieve the outcomes? Lack of time, resistance to change, lack of incentives. These are well-known barriers, and I'd like to investigate them a bit further later in a separate research project. There's also the revised role for academics. They no longer need to just walk into the classroom, deliver their lecture and walk out. And of course, particularly in Oxford, this is a challenge because the students have so much freedom of choice. They are mentored by their tutors, but the tutor will say, for example, there's a series of four lectures happening next month. If you'd like to go along to them, go along to them. So the lecturers are not necessarily the ones that are supporting and mentoring their students. Those are possibly the tutors instead. So this brings different roles for both tutors and lecturers. The proliferation of emerging technologies, and of course dealing with new versions of the software. We are in the process of upgrading from the old version of WebLearn, which was a system called Boddington, and now moving to Sakai, which is the new version. So again, there's resistance and there's doubt as to how long will the new version last before you're going to upgrade to something else. The challenges for our team, I'll just move quickly through this. I've already alluded to the unique and complex nature of the collegiate university and the different roles, no uniformity across the institution. So we simply have to invite people to participate. We're here to support you. There's no such thing as a top-down approach or saying a certain percentage of courses should be supported by the VLE. We have the small central team, which I've mentioned. We're soon losing some of our Sakai developers because the system is now so-called built. So the money that was there to pay developers to build it has run out, and so instead of having five in our team, we're only going to have three. Training, I'm involved, as I said, in the staff development and staff training workshops. We have a mixed target audience, so it's not just academics that come to our training courses. It's students, it's academics, it's administrators, researchers, and even retired people, retired staff members from the university. So I must say, at least with the VLE training courses, we don't have students. We know that we are talking to the people who are going to be designing and building areas in the VLE. Encouraging users to use the VLE for more than just an information repository. So as I say, that's encouraging them to move up that step continuum to steps 2 and 3. And being open source, there's this expectation that the VLE can just be programmed to do anything. You know, we need a registration system for students to sign up to tests. We need a venue booking system, and we can just build our VLE and change it, and it can just do any of these things, which puts a huge load on our development team, which is dwindling. So the pedagogical questions, which I don't attempt to answer, and these are the things that are totally in the front of my mind all the time, and these are the kinds of questions that we get from our academics. Why do I need to use the VLE when I see my students weekly in small tutorial groups? And that's a very real challenge. When I was interviewed for this job, the interview panel asked me, what would you say to an academic who says that? And I said, well, how small is small? Because coming from Africa, I'm used to, you know, classes of 300, 500, 800. I said, how small is small? They said, well, one or two. So that is an ongoing challenge, this blend and getting the balance right. And what can the VLE provide that I can't achieve with email and a website? We find that academics at Oxford are very self-sufficient. They've got other mailing lists. They've got other tools for blogging if they want to use it. They've got websites, so they don't actually see the need for a VLE. So it's an uphill battle for us all the time. The initiatives we've undertaken, I've listed here case studies. I was interested to hear about your case studies, the previous speakers. We at the moment have written case studies only, but we are considering the use of video and audio case studies. We have a collection of exemplar sites in WebLearn, which are freely available, so teachers can go and look at, see these copies of sites as to what other teachers are doing, formal training sessions, exploratory workshops, and then re-energizing the WebLearn user group, which is this group that I mentioned where we plotted where they were on the curve. So these are the lessons that we've learned in our efforts so far to try and reach academics. We found it very helpful to re-energize this user group. The user group had existed for a while, but it had sort of gone downhill, and you would get one or two or three people turning up at the meetings, and they were the same champions. And so it was really necessary to re-energize this group. So we've done that since November last year, and we've made sure that it's focused on sharing ideas and best practice. Rather than us as learning technologists giving demonstrations, we want to hear from the users as to what they want to hear, and they've said they want to have show-and-tell sessions from their peers. So that's what we do. We have a meeting once a term. It's planned well in advance so that they can diarize it. We have the show-and-tell sessions. As I said, we have experts on copyright and issues that really need to be addressed from the point of view of the academics. We've even enticed them by giving them a cream tea at the end of the two-hour session, and that's worked, and that's becoming a tradition. We do it very cheaply. We go and buy the scones ourselves and the jam and cream, so we don't get caterers in. It's very cheap, and so people come for the 1.5 hours of the sharing ideas, and then we chat some more over the cream tea, and that's worked very well. We have a support site in WebLearn called the WebLearn Guidance Site, and that is my difficulty in trying to keep that community alive, because we don't have the time to actively facilitate the community online. So at the moment we're using it simply for announcements, email lists and agendas, and putting up the copies of the show and tell screencasts so that people who were not at the face-to-face meeting can at least watch those. We're now in the process of developing video tutorials. And what we've done there again is try to address the users by asking the user group beforehand, what do you want to see in a video? Here are three examples, evaluate them, tell us which ones you prefer and why. We'll go and build some sample videos and then get the users again to evaluate those. So we hope that by involving the users right throughout the design of those video tutorials, we'll land up with some very useful video. By tutorials, I mean screen captures of how to use the tools in the VLE. Not only how, but how and why. So we try to model best practice in our use of blended learning and using low threshold technology. So with the workshops that we have, there are two there that I mentioned, we get the participants to reflect on their teaching philosophy first. We use case studies, we use the GIST case studies, their book Effective Learning in a Digital Age is really useful. And we focus on low threshold technologies like using Audacity or Screen Toaster, which is a very easy way to make screen captures. And using audio commentaries to do something that we think would help the lecturers. Instead of having to write written feedback on student essays, what about giving an audio commentary? So those are the kind of low-threshold technologies we try and introduce. And in our workshops, we also try and make use of some of the technology that we're advocating, such as the clickers or the personal voting systems. And that's turned out to be very popular. We've also decided to employ student interns. So this summer, we have two student interns. It's a formal initiative by the university to involve students, give them some work experience. So we have two of them. They are going out and interviewing academics about their use of technology. So this will result in some video case studies. And one of them is focusing on developing these video screencasts as to how to use the tools in the VLE. Luckily, the student who's doing this, she's doing her master's in e-learning, so she's also very focused on the importance of the pedagogy and the design. She spent 3 weeks so far just looking at the planning and the design of these tutorials, the questionnaire for the users, and writing detailed scripts. So we'll have the detailed scripts for the screencasts, whether we actually have an audio commentary for it all or we have a combination of audio and subtitles, we're not sure yet. This is, I think, the last slide. This just summarizes all the support that we offer academics, the formal sessions. We have free scheduled weekly consultation sessions. So that's during term time, every Friday for 2 hours, we're on duty, as well as the IT teachers who teach other IT skills. So that's a free and open invitation. People can come in and we can sit with them. Centralized email support. What we found very useful is customized departmental and committee sessions. So my manager and I offer our services to go along to committees and departments and give a 10 or 15 minute information session or overview. And that's worked very well, particularly teaching and learning policy committees. We've got our foot in the door there, and then they go and talk to people in their departments and divisions, and we found that a lot of them are then coming to contact us. So that's a selection of some of the support material that we offer. Step-by-step PDF guides on the use of the tools. Least you need to know guides. This idea we got from Indiana University because, as Karen said, you don't want to have to go through a 25-page document. So these least you need to know guides are just 2 sides, and it's just a quick getting started. We've also got the how-to guides, how to create a PDF, how to record using Audacity, and the video tutorials that I've mentioned. So that's just a summary of the kind of initiatives we're using to try and engage our academics in using, in particular, the VLE. So just to finish off then, this is our challenge, the over 800-year-old institution, but we need to look at the academics and their needs and the students and their expectations in this immersive learning environment that is so unique and so traditional. Thank you.
Questions?
That was really interesting. I think I resonate with that completely because I'm doing more or less what you're doing in Nicosia. Just, I mean, about 100 questions actually. Maybe I'll ask you any of them during the break. But is there a policy statement that that Oxford University wants to have a certain percentage of its courses blended or fully online by a certain time? There's no
nothing whatsoever.
So really, you just you don't get. There's no expectations for you to get more courses online.
Well, there's an expectation for us to justify our jobs.
Can I just put that in the back the background? Because I know that Harvard University, I think the Ivy League universities, they had a big problem with their pension schemes. You know, this stock market crash, and I read an article that they wanted to get more of their courses, university courses, online,
mm-hmm.
and lower the prices.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that kind of market that there were financial reasons why they wanted to do that,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I kind of presume at Harvard there might be more overt pressure on people like you to get the lectures, to get their stuff online, or be more responsive. Whereas here it seems to be more, would you like to do it online? If not, don't feel any pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be some sense of that this is a threatening situation for the lecturer, that there is a covert or pressure to feel that maybe why is she asking me to do that? Maybe she wants, you know, there's some covert pressure on the lecturers here maybe, and that may lead to even more resistance. Have you found anything like that here?
No, I haven't found any COVID pressure. I think lecturers hold dear this tutorial system. The Oxford and Cambridge tutorial system is very close to their hearts, so they might feel that that is threatened with more and more on resources being available online. But I think that's why we have to tread very carefully and not have any sense of targets or a certain percentage of courses have to be available online. Because of the whole Socratic model that I sketched. On the other side of the coin, we do have a lot of resources which we make available globally in an open source environment, which is what Melissa is talking about. So our podcasting team, you know, we've got a good presence on iTunes U, so we are reaching out there to make some of our resources available across the world.
I'm sorry, I forgot to mention one thing. There's a term that I'll mention in my presentation. It's called cannibalization. I kind of termed it myself. And this is what happens when an e-learning course replaces a face-to-face course.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not financially viable, maybe for the university to offer to double up the courses,
mm-hmm.
it's more expenditure. So they prefer to go for one or the other. And some lecturers feel very threatened when they see their peers maybe creating e-learning courses. So they think they may lose their face-to-face courses. And that's that whole process, cannibalization. Do you get anything like that here at Oxford where an e-learning course may...
No. In fact, we avoid the term e-learning online completely. Perhaps this is answering your question. Because e-learning and online seems to imply I can do it by myself at home. So we talk about technology-enhanced learning.
Well, you said that you had some full e-learning courses, I think. Is that one of the columns there was...
No, that was really just the conceptual framework.
Oh, okay.
We might have a handful of master's programs. Yes, there are just really a handful. One is in community-based health, where the students are adults who are working and they come to Oxford for a few contact sessions. When Melissa was talking about distance learning this morning, she was talking about our continuing education program, which is completely separate. So I'm talking about the face-to-face environment, blended learning, and yes, there might be a handful of courses that are up on that level 3, but really just a handful. Okay. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Right. Back to lunch now, which is in the Buttery, which you sort of have to go back down into the quadrangle and turn right, and you see some of the signs following you around. And then we start back at the main sessions, I think, in about an hour's time. I'll confirm that. Yeah, at 1:30 the sessions will start again.